Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from The James at Ohio State, providing access to the most advanced cancer treatments available from a team specialized in treating just one type of cancer, yours. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/choosethejames.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jarvish. What is life like in East Palestine, Ohio today, 3 years after the tiny town became national news following a massive train derailment? A subsequent chemical burn spewed over 1 million pounds of vinyl chloride and other industrial chemicals into the air and water. East Palestine is a town on the border of Ohio and Pennsylvania, so it affected people in two states. Today, we're catching up with what's going on the ground there and how residents are doing and how the town is recovering. Joining us now is attorney Mindy Bish, managing partner at the Keenan Law Firm, and she is the lead trial counsel representing hundreds of East Palestine residents. Welcome to All Sides, Mindy.
Good morning. How are you?
And also joining us is a lifelong resident of East Palestine, Jamie Wallace, who after the derailment moved about 15 miles away. She still has family living in town. Shortly after the disaster, she co-founded a community organization called the Unity Council for East Palestine Train Derailment to help residents. And she now leads a group called Chemically Impacted Communities Coalition, a nationwide network of communities affected by toxic chemical incidents. Welcome to All Sides, Jamie.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for not forgetting about us.
Jamie, take us back 3 years. So it's February 3rd, 2023. 38 rail cars from Norfolk Southern careen off the track. When did you become aware that a disaster was unfolding in your town?
I became aware when I started hearing sirens. In a small town, you know, you hear an ambulance, you jump up and look out the window because you think you know that person. So the first time I knew anything was going on was from the sirens, and then my mother called. There was no formal announcement. There was no warning. It was basically by word of mouth that we found out about the derailment. Mm-hmm.
The National Transportation Safety Board in 2024 determined that a defective wheel bearing is what caused the derailment. And then the NTSB also said the decision to vent and burn tanker cars that were filled with vinyl chloride was, quote, unnecessary. And it happened based on incomplete and misleading information. So, Jamie, later on in the hour, we're going to talk to Dr. Patrice Gollum, she's in the next segment, and we're going to talk to her about some health research related to that chemical burn. But can you tell us about your health? What did you experience in the initial days following the derailment and the chemical burn?
Well, I'll tell you, I actually kind of had a small argument with my husband before I went home for the first time. He said, what are we going to do when they lift this evacuation? And I said, we're going to go home. If the EPA says it's fine, it's fine. Mm. I went back to my home to grab prescription medications, something we didn't think about grabbing when we rushed out of the house. As soon as I pulled in my driveway, my skin started turning red. My face was burning. I couldn't breathe. I started coughing. And I look over at the small stream right next. It runs probably 10 steps in front of my front door, and I just see chemicals free flowing down the creek. I knew right then it wasn't safe. I listened to my body. I continued to have symptoms every time I went into East Palestine. And now those symptoms have turned to long-term illness. I'm now suffering from hypothyroidism, asthma, cyst on my ovary, and memory issues. And that's not the worst things that we're seeing in our community at this point.
Mm. Well, and can you tell us a little bit about the decision to move from your longtime home? Were you able to sell your house?
I actually was only renting at the time. Mm. I had just moved home from Cleveland. I had worked up in Cleveland for 15 years. So I was just renting my home, and actually we never went back because I threw a fit. I got a toxicologist from the railroad to come into my house, and when he seen moisture going down the basement wall, he knew it was from the creek, and he told us that if that water would puddle, it would off-gas. The next day, Norfolk Southern called and basically said, give us a number. We'll get you out of there. Instead of giving them that number, I went to the town hall, and I told everybody. I knew it wasn't just my house. You know, there was no way that it was just the one person that had a big mouth in town whose house was contaminated, and I couldn't leave my community behind.
Attorney Mindy Bish, I want to bring you into the conversation here. You are the lead trial counsel. You represented hundreds of residents. Help us understand all the layers of legal issues here stemming from the derailment. I'm sure it was complicated to tackle.
Well, I mean, first of all, it was mostly complicated because of the class action suit and where it left everyone. And so the class action attorneys dragged people into a personal injury release without the residents really understanding the risks that they were facing following the derailment. And so first we had to analyze, was there some justice we could bring people who unknowingly opted into a personal injury release without understanding the risks after having viewed a video that was really just a PR hit? Then we signed up the people that have opted out, which has been continuous since that period of time. And went about hiring the experts that were needed for this kind of a case and really joined the community to show them that there were attorneys that weren't like the class action attorneys, which really was the hardest part. These people were used to attorneys that basically betrayed them. So having to come into the community and prove to them that not all attorneys were like that and earn trust so that you could work to help them was one of the hardest things to do.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about East Palestine, 3 years after the train derailment disaster, with former East Palestine resident Jamie Wallace and with attorney Mindy Bish. Jamie, overnight, it sounds like you and other residents became accidental activists. You know, in the days after the derailment, I'm sure that, as Mindy was just saying, lawyers descended upon the town, health experts, businesses. How did you handle and the other residents handle all of this onslaught of attention at the time?
You know, you just do what comes naturally. I'm a mother. I was raised that you protect your children at all cost. So it wasn't something that we asked for, but it wasn't something we were going to shut up about either. And trust me, we made Mindy earn that trust. We'd been lied to by every single branch of the government at this point. We had been lied to by our own attorneys, and we had been abandoned. So trust is something that we don't give easily in our community anymore after what we've experienced.
Well, and that brings us back to Mindy with the lawsuits. So let's talk about that $600 million settlement from Norfolk Southern and why some residents are unhappy with it. Mindy, can you tell us, some residents agreed, is that the settlement you mean? Some residents agreed to the $600 million settlement and now they want to be released from it?
Yes. So realize it was a $600 million settlement, which was, in my opinion, woefully low. It, by the time that you took out the attorney fees and all the costs, you're talking about a little over 400 million. They set aside about 129 million and they settled out the personal injury. They told residents they advertised that you could get a personal injury settlement of up to $25,000. And they put out this formula that residents could calculate. The biggest problem they had is that everyone, and these attorneys were experienced enough that they had to have known this, that the cancers and the serious diseases take years to show up. So when you're coming to people a year after this kind of a disaster, or even 15 months, and you're asking them to give up their personal injury claims, on a whole, you're doing that before the serious diseases will start to show themselves. So what they did is they went and they got this Arch Carson to come and do a video for them. He was not the expert. They didn't release any of their own expert reports, Stephen Petty, who had done all this testing, his report is still in hiding and hasn't been released to the very people who paid for it. And Arch Carson came on and said, I would not expect anyone to get cancer or sick from any of this. And the class action lawyers told everyone this was just some independent guy who came in and wanted to calm everyone down. The documentation and the emails show that his video was produced by a PR company hired by the class action lawyers and held on to, and then put in this meeting right before the deadline for people to sign up. And here we are, almost 3 years later. And guess what's happening? All the serious diseases and the cancers and people are dying, which everyone should have known those things were going to happen. And they did nothing.
Jamie,
They did nothing.
did you sign on to the original $600 million class action?
Absolutely not. I actually, encourage residents to actually read the settlement agreement. The problem was we only had, I think, a little over a month to make our decision to opt in or out, and it was basically a crap roll. You're rolling the dice. You didn't know what you were going to get, but they wanted you to sign on. After I heard Dr. Carson speak, again, I don't have to be a scientist to know what these chemicals do. We see it. I mean, look at the 9/11 victims. I knew that there was no way he could say zero cases of cancer. The first thing I did was Google him and found his LinkedIn profile. Mr. Carson had worked for Chevron, Exxon, Dow Chemicals, and a couple other major energy companies. I knew right then that our attorneys were not being truthful with us. And if they were not being truthful with us, I wasn't signing on to any type of settlement that they had come to an agreement on.
We did reach out to Norfolk Southern last week. We invited them to join the show. Their press person said no one was available, but she did provide a statement and some background information. It's too much to share here on the radio, but I will read their statement. So this is their statement. Since the 2023 derailment, the Norfolk Southern team has followed through on our commitments, completing site restoration activities, restoring local waterways, and establishing long-term monitoring plans for drinking water and community health. We've taken meaningful action to help East Palestine recover, and we remain committed to continuing to work with the national, state, and local partners to deliver a stronger future for the community. For additional information about the Norfolk Southern's work in East Palestine, visit nsmakingitright.com. So that's their statement. So Jamie, I wanted to get your response. I mean, do you feel like the railroad has tried to right some wrongs here? Do you give them any? Do you give them some credit?
No, absolutely not. They declare that everything was clean. There's still contamination. Again, I don't have to be a scientist to know that when we had record flooding, not this past summer, the summer before, and there was chemicals in the water that flooded, that chemical went into our soil. And no one will test the soil. I was down at the creeks just in June of 2023, or sorry, June of this past year, 2025. And I saw the contamination with my own eyes. It took me 2 minutes to take a shovel and hit that sediment. It has spread to the point now where I don't think they can ever clean it up as far as helping the community. Our village leaders, I don't care, I'll say it, they were openly bought off. Norfolk Southern, put in a $25 million park, and they were supposed to put in a training center, which they ended up crushing. They were doing all this stuff for the community, but they forgot about the people. It was all focused on economic recovery and not on the people and health issues. So, in my opinion, Norfolk Southern has not held up to their end of the bargain about making it right. Maybe in their eyes, they made it right. But in my eyes, they absolutely did not make it right.
And we will be talking to the East Palestine Village Manager a little bit later about some of those on the ground improvements, and I'll ask him about the people and health issue part. But Mindy, back to you for a second about the lawsuit you have going on now. So if there was the $600 million settlement, are you working with just people who were not involved in that, or like, can you get out of it, I guess, is what I'm saying, if people wanted out?
We filed a motion for some of the people that was timely to try to get them out. It's no longer timely to try to get people out. So there's really no mechanism that we can find to get people out. You know, the one thing that I will tell you, and it's really important, especially when you talk to the other people, if I might go back a little bit. Number one, the EPA did no testing in East Palestine. All the testing that was done by contractors hired by Norfolk Southern. And those contractors were supposed to be under the supervision of the EPA. And the EPA took those contractors' testing numbers and put them on their own website. The city managers and all of the people in East Palestine have refused to look at the testing that Scott Smith has done. The testing that shows that the ground is more contaminated right now than it was after the derailment, that the water is more contaminated now and widespread than after the derailment. So the key question is, if it's all so clean, then why not look at Scott's testing? Why not do the testing? Why not disprove it all? They absolutely have, we've invited them to come and look. They have refused. Instead, what they're doing is they are looking for economic redevelopment to bring people back to East Palestine when I have clients who are dying who live there with cancer. So they want to put their head in the sand. They want people to come back down. Now, I will tell you, there are ways to clean that area up. It is not for nothing. In other words, it isn't shut the town down. But first, people have to recognize the fact that it's contaminated. Norfolk Southern has done nothing. 3 days after this derailment, they were lifting up the train tracks, trying to put new train tracks down so the trains could keep running. They have not cleaned it up. They have not recognized anything. They have done nothing but deny the injuries that they have caused, and they have left East Palestine as contaminated, if not more contaminated, than it was before they ever started. They left these people to die at the beginning, and they're still dying now.
Well, we're running out of time, but just to end on, I wanted to see where we were right now, Mindy Bish, since you are you working on, is it a basically a different class action lawsuit? Is it a civil suit, or like what? Where are we at in this process? Can you sue? Can Norfolk Southern be sued twice? I guess, is there double jeopardy?
Norfolk Southern is being sued by the people who opted out. They cannot be sued by the people who opted in. But what we're looking at is we're looking at the CDC, we're looking at the EPA, we're looking at the contractors who were there after the settlement, who continued to move the dirt around, continued to contaminate the East Palestine, and continued to make people sick, for the people who opted in to see if there is a viable path of recovery for them for their continuing illnesses. Based on the way the cleanup was done after April of 2024.
All right. Well, you'll have to keep us up to date on where things go from there. I want to say thank you to attorney Mindy Bish, managing partner at Keenan's Law Firm, who is representing hundreds of East Palestine residents. Mindy, thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
And thank you to Jamie Wallace, a lifelong East Palestine resident, until the derailment caused her to move about 15 miles away. Jamie, thank you so much for joining us today and telling us your story.
No, thank you. Without news coverage, we've already been left to die. But this continuing coverage means more to us than you will ever know. So thank you.
Coming up, we are going to talk about what East Palestine residents and Gulf War veterans have in common with a medical doctor who is researching the connection. That is when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube. But what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY. You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. In an environmental disaster like East Palestine train derailment, residents need to be studied over time to evaluate symptoms, to document if and how symptoms are changing or worsening, and to see if they mimic other known illnesses. One medical doctor has researched and linked symptoms found in residents of East Palestine to those found in veterans of the Gulf War. Joining us now is Dr. Beatrice Alexandra Gullum, director of the Gullum Research Group. And she served as a primary care doctor for a panel of veterans for over 15 years. She's also a professor of medicine at the University of California, San Diego School of Medicine. Welcome to All Sides, Dr. Gullum.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So at what point did you become interested in learning about the medical conditions of residents of East Palestine? Was it right away after the derailment, or did you hear about it later?
Virtually right away. I began hearing this messaging that said everything is fine. There's nothing to see here. The levels of chemicals are all within safe limits. At the same time that people were saying they were sick, and that was redolent of what happened following the Gulf War, where veterans came back, said they were sick, and told there was no problem, until there was actually research that showed, in fact, they were ill at markedly elevated rates. And now we've had 3.5 decades of research that has incontrovertibly tied their many health problems to their exposures and shown underlying mechanisms and is beginning to identify usable treatments. So the hope was to get involved earlier, to accelerate that process, and if possible, learn from past exposures involving mixed multiple chemicals, which our data suggested involved underlying shared mechanisms. Different Gulf War veterans had different mixtures of toxic exposures, and yet they had a shared profile of illness. And this makes sense based on a particular mechanism that my lab documented, which are damage to the energy powerhouses of cells called mitochondria. That's part of the toxicity profile of essentially every single chemical, that mitochondrial impairment and the intertwined oxidative stress. And so that mechanism can sum and synergize across chemicals of widely varying chemical types and mechanisms of action to readily surpass toxic thresholds, even if each individual chemical is within safe limits.
What symptoms came up in East Palestine residents that made you think of the Gulf War veterans and the similarities? Jamie in our last segment described her skin was tingling, she was coughing, that kind of thing.
Yeah, so many symptoms. So we're more concerned with the persistent symptoms than the immediate irritant symptoms, but headache, fatigue, cognitive problems, mood problems, skin problems, gastrointestinal problems, respiratory problems, pain problems, all of those are actually part and parcel of the diagnostic criteria for Gulf War illness, and those were all showing up in East Palestine.
There's a new tracker residents can use. Can you tell us about that and if residents have been participating in the tracker?
Yeah, so in addition to our main survey study, we initiated a symptom tracker, and within 1 week, I think we had around 80 people that had been sharing their new symptoms. It's both for people who are in the study and people who are not, but that's to enable us to follow as symptoms continue to evolve following the derailment. We know in Gulf War veterans that in that case, veterans came back and left the area where there were exposures, and yet the data show that 40% of the elevated symptoms in Gulf War veterans took at least a year following that to emerge. So we know that this same mechanism, this mitochondrial impairment, is very well known to cause delayed variable latency to symptom onset, and that's what we're seeing in East Palestine as well. Of course, in East Palestine, there's the additional factor that people are continuing to be exposed, as you just heard.
So after the train derailment, a decision was made to do this chemical burn. So it spewed a million pounds of vinyl chloride and other chemicals into the air and water. What does a chemical like vinyl chloride do to the body?
Well, when it's burned, it creates a substance called phosgene, which was actually used as a chemical warfare agent in World War I. So that's obviously not a good thing. But one of the things it does in the body is it it goes to these energy powerhouses called mitochondria, where there's an enzyme, which I don't know if you probably don't need the fancy name, that that bioconverts it to a more toxic intermediate, and in the process creates this free radical injury. That's the intertwined mechanism we spoke about, that then goes on to create multiple forms of damage. That oxidative stress, that free radical damage that antioxidants help to protect against, which you've heard about in cereal commercials, et cetera, has many downstream effects, including cell death, inflammation, impaired blood flow, coagulation activation, thrombosis, increased bleeding risk because it affects the junctions that hold the blood vessel cells to one another, many, many different potential downstream actions. And these help to explain many of the symptoms that you heard about in Ispassine, including early on the bloody noses, et cetera.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about research into the health problems with East Palestine residents with Dr. Beatrice Gollum from UC San Diego School of Medicine. So in the last segment, we talked to longtime East Palestine resident Jamie Wallace. She talked about her symptoms. She said she's moved away, but her symptoms haven't gotten better. She's sicker now. What do we know about long-term symptoms with the proximity to the derailment site?
Well, again, if we draw lessons from Gulf War veterans, and let me just share what some of the similarities are. So the diagnostic symptom criteria for Gulf War illness, we found in our initial survey that even though we took people who were and were not affected, of course, affected people are disproportionately interested, 73% actually met the symptom criteria for Gulf War illness. The ones that met those symptom criteria had the same top ongoing symptoms as we see in Gulf War veterans. They had the same top lab abnormality, which is a marker of inflammation. Just as in Gulf War veterans, rather than inflammation being tied to more severe illness, it's counterintuitively tied to less severe illness, a very distinctive feature that's shared between the two phenomena. In both cases, that inflammation is tied to biological drivers of cell death. Cell death can cause inflammation. It looks like that's the mechanism of inflammation in these settings. Membrane abnormalities are tied to illness in both cases. And the emerging conditions that we're hearing reported in East Palestine are matched to the conditions that were ultimately shown to be, frankly, elevated in Gulf War veterans. Everything from hypertension and heart disease to seizure disorders, gastroesophageal reflux, sleep apnea, et cetera. Those are all conditions that are known to be elevated in Gulf War veterans. In Gulf War veterans, 35 years out, the data really are that people who got ill early mostly remained ill, and then on top of that, you know, sort of added on the age-related complications to their illness over time. So most people who became ill did not recover. Of course, that we're hoping might still be different, and also we're working to find modifiable factors that, you know, where we can intervene and people can intervene, healthcare practices, even simple things like smoking and alcohol, very low levels activate that enzyme that I told you about that makes vinyl chloride become more toxic. So even low-level smoking and alcohol, we found in East Palestine, were illness magnifiers. They were not the cause of the illness, but because they amplify the toxicity of the vinyl chloride, they're contributors to the illness. And then there are other, you know, factors that people could intervene on, and we're identifying intermediate conditions that were elevated in Gulf War illness that then in turn amplify the underlying mechanisms of toxic illness, like sleep apnea, which is both first caused by cell energy impairment and then contributes to it, where if people treat that, then that may also portend less onset of problems later. Finally, in Gulf War veterans, we conducted a study of a nutritional supplement called coenzyme Q10, which is actually a substance, a vitamin-like substance that's made by the body, but often in insufficient amounts, particularly where there are toxins like this. And that led to significant benefit in a small placebo-controlled study to symptoms and objectively measured function in Gulf War veterans. And we're initiating a pilot study in East Palestine to see whether we can achieve evidence suggestive of benefits. It's going to be quite small feasibility study that we hope will allow us to take it to a larger study.
So you're going to try giving those same supplements to people in East Palestine? Is that what
you
mean?
Yes, and again, in a placebo-controlled double-blind study so that we can actually draw inferences about the causal benefit of the treatment in that setting.
Now, you studied Gulf War vets for decades, as you just said. I mean, you mentioned 35 years. So to get a true sense of their medical issues, how long would East Palestine residents need to be studied? I mean, we're only 3 years after the train derailment here.
Well, of course, it depends on for what outcome. As you heard in the previous segment, cancers and things take much longer to appear typically. We do know that there is now something called the PACT Act that presumptively service connects Gulf War veterans and burn pit exposed, and of course the East Palestine derailment and subsequent both the original burn of many cars followed by the intentional vent and burn. Those produced burned mixed toxic chemicals similar to burn pits. Those involve multiple different respiratory conditions and multiple different cancer types that have been presumptively service-connected, meaning that if people develop those respiratory conditions or develop those cancers and they were in that exposure environment, you can presume that the two are related. So that is something that I think we should be watching for, whether we're seeing elevations in those conditions. We certainly see that the respiratory conditions are elevated, and we're certainly hearing emergence of the cancer types that are PACT Act service connected, like lung cancer, like male breast cancer, et cetera.
You're not the only doctor researching different areas related to residents of East Palestine. How are medical professionals collaborating, sharing information, or are you keeping your study separate?
Well, I think I might be the only doctor, at least from the initial study group. The others were PhDs. From the initial NIEHS, National Institute of Environmental Health and Safety funding, I was the only MD in that group. But certainly in the original what are called R21 rapid response funding, they did actually hold regular meetings to enable collaboration among the investigators. But we were really the only group that was focused on the approach that we're talking about and that was focused on looking at the illnesses, trying to understand the underlying mechanisms so that we could intervene to prevent them. I don't think it's useful the traditional environmental epidemiology approach, which is important, is to, measure exposures carefully and then track how they relate to illness. This is a setting where you will never get good quality measurement of all the exposures, just as you couldn't really in the Gulf War. And a lot of the important information that emerged that ultimately was helpful to Gulf War veterans did not involve that expensive large sample, slow approach to identifying conditions, but involved looking at how illness, when it emerged, related to underlying mechanisms and markers. And that's the approach that we're trying to use. And then we're able to capitalize on what we've learned before for this other mixed toxic exposure setting with the goal to accelerate understanding and help for those who are there.
We've been talking with Dr. Beatrice Alexandra Galam, who serves as the primary care doctor for a panel of veteran patients for over 15 years, and she is also a professor of medicine at the University of California San Diego School of Medicine. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much.
And coming up, we're going to hear from East Palestine's village manager on efforts to revive the town's economy. And we'll hear from an IdeaStream public media reporter who's been following state and federal legislation related to the rail industry. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News. You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. We're talking today about East Palestine, Ohio, a village in Columbiana County on the Ohio-Pennsylvania border. It made national news 3 years ago after a train derailment and subsequent chemical burn of the contents of some of the train cars. How does a town help its residents recover from an environmental disaster while working to revive the local economy? As Knoll Fork Southern's freight trains continue to rumble through the village every day. Joining us now is East Palestine's village manager, Antonio Diaz-Guy, a lifelong resident of the area. Thank you for joining us, Antonio.
Absolutely. Happy to be here.
So I know your time is limited, so let's get right to it. In a recent interview with the New York Times, you described the train derailment on the heels of the COVID shutdown as, quote, getting punched in the face again. So you're fairly new to your role as village manager, though. You took the position about a year ago. How are you managing the ongoing issues that stem from the train derailment? How do you feel like it's going?
I think it's going well, given what we've been handed. Our only path is forward. And so coming from an area that was historically disinvested to begin with, and then having COVID-19 and the train derailment, our approach is twofold. Do the small things right at a high level, and then be extremely aggressive on our economic growth patterns. Because I think raising per capita income is going to resolve a lot of the community's concerns around healthcare, around time in the community, around relocations, if people decide they want to leave the community. We're doing both those things.
Now, you're trying to grow business. One way you're trying to lure businesses to town is you're speeding up the permitting process. Has that helped? Have you had any businesses grow?
Yeah, it has helped. So business in my world is also twofold, sort of small town retail and food shops, and then large scale commercial and industrial businesses. For those larger scale businesses, this permitting process has sped up dramatically. And we do see interest in organizations wanting to move into the community because we have this opportunity. So something that could have taken 3 to 4 months going through the state of Ohio's process could now take 3 to 4 weeks maximum. So it's given us a competitive advantage.
Norfolk Southern is often painted as the villain in this story. It was their train that derailed. They did the chemical burn that was deemed unnecessary. Residents are unhappy with the payouts from the settlement. But the company says it has taken a lot of steps to make things right. Do you agree that the company is trying to make things right?
I do, and that's certainly a complicated question. I think in the wake of the derailment, the immediate 6 months following, everybody was still in emergency response mode. And so there's a little bit of grace given to every party in my mind there. I can only speak for my interactions with them since I took this job. They have lived up to their commitments that they've made here. And as we come to a close on some of those commitments, you know, I'm just, you know, hoping that continues to be the process.
Now, I know that they've poured some money, arguably a lot of money, into the community. But we were talking earlier with former resident Jamie Wallace, and she disagrees. She says that she doesn't think that Norfolk Southern has tried to make things right. She said that you know, people like you in the village manager position you're worried about economic development, but you need to be more worried about people and health issues. What would you say to that?
Yeah, so I'm worried about both, right? I think those things can't easily be disentangled. In fact, we opened a new research facility in East Palestine because one of the things we have to do is, we have to monitor individuals' health as a result of this derailment and make sure that if there are any, you know, trends that are non-normal, that we catch them early and we can seek proper treatment. But also, I'm completely committed to the health of the community. And I think that's why yesterday I made the commitment that we need to be the healthiest town we can be, regardless of what's happened in the past. So everything from dietary changes, smoking, drinking changes, having facilities where the public can freely access, recreational activities. I think we need to take a really holistic approach at this and say, how can we remove all the confounding variables that contribute to negative health outcomes? Let's take that risk off the table. And we should do that regardless.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about East Palestine after the train derailment with village manager Antonio Diaz-Guy. The attorney we talked to earlier, Mindy Bish, also mentioned something that she called the Smith Report, which she says that the contamination is worse now than it was even right after the disaster. I don't know if you're familiar with this report or if you agree. Do you feel like the area is still contaminated?
I'm not familiar with the report, so I don't want to speak directly to it. Mm-hmm. But it's my belief that the area is probably substantially cleaner now than it was 20 years ago, given the industrial past of this area.
In the 2020 census, East Palestine's population was just under 5,000. What is it today?
just under 5,000. Yeah. So the population stayed pretty stagnant. As part of sort of that like Appalachian Rust Belt America area, I keep saying we're at the intersection of corn country, coal country, and the foothills of Appalachia. That population has declined over time due to household sizes shrinking. So while our housing occupancy has been pretty static, the town's population has continued to go down and down. And the solution to that is to build more housing, right? I think that housing on the market here sells very quickly at a good price. We simply don't have enough houses to attract more people.
Norfolk Southern last year agreed to be acquired by Union Pacific, and regulators are still evaluating this because it's a huge merger. It might be a couple of years. But do you have any concerns from the village's standpoint if Norfolk Southern is no longer involved because they were acquired?
Yeah, the beautiful thing about the American legal system is that these contracts are inherited through acquisitions, through mergers. So from a contractual standpoint, what the letter of the law says, I'm not concerned at all. Now, certainly there are, individuals we've been working with. If those individuals change, it could make things more complicated. But I believe a good contract and two good parties make for a great system.
Is there anything more, before I let you go, is there anything more you'd like our listeners to know about East Palestine? We're at the third anniversary of this disaster. What do you want people to know about your community?
Yeah, so I've had the privilege of traveling all over the country, and there's some really great parts of the United States, and there's some really not so great parts of the United States. East Palestine is a great place to be. It's a great place for raising a family, for coming back and having a relaxing retirement location. And I think that, 3 years ago yesterday, people genuinely came to the community and said, how can we help? We want to provide support. But being a small town, not having a list of projects, not having a deep staff, we were not prepared to answer those questions. We did not know what we needed assistance for. Now, 3 years removed, we have a very clear vision of what that is. And I'm hoping that those offers of help and assistance are still out there and that we can still call on them, because now we still need to move forward. And the stigma around this derailment is certainly an artificial barrier that exists to that progress. So, I would say anybody who offered help before, please get in contact with me and my team here, because we know exactly what we need and we are pushing full force ahead.
Well, I want to thank you for your time. I know you have a busy day. We've been talking with East Palestine Village Manager Antonio Diaz-Guy. Thank you for joining us.
Yep, thank you.
Joining us now, we have IdeaStream Public Media's Akron Canton reporter, Abigail Botar. Welcome back, Abigail.
Good morning.
So on the third anniversary of the East Palestine train derailment, Congresswoman Amelia Sykes, representing the Akron area, introduced a bill to address rail safety, the Railroad Safety and Accountability Act. Can you tell me about that bill?
Yeah, absolutely. So this bill would codify a group created by the Federal Railroad Administration called the Railroad Safety Advisory Committee. And this group develops new regulatory standards for the rail community. It's comprised of workers, of businesses, union members, and people from these rail corporations. And last year, the Department of Transportation, which all of this is under, actually disbanded this committee along with two dozen other committees. So that's kind of where this legislation stems from, is concern, as a lot of things have been under the Trump administration, concern that these outstanding committees and projects aren't going from presidential administration to presidential administration like they're intended to. So this bill would codify this specific advisory committee to make sure that it's still able to provide input on regulatory standards for the rail community, no matter who the president is. The Department of Transportation did announce last month that it will be reestablishing the committee. So it should be back in a different version. It will have less members, which some unions that represent rail workers have shared concerns about the perhaps imbalance of who's on the committee. So it is coming back, but this legislation is to ensure that it stays available no matter who is in the White House.
Your story noted, though, yesterday that no bills addressing railroad safety have passed since the derailment. So does a Congresswoman Sykes feel like hers could? Obviously, yeah. She's gonna say yes. But if nothing has passed, then yeah.
She is frustrated. She mm-hmm. says that the Republican leadership have been blocking. There's a specific bill that she and a bipartisan group of Ohio's congressional delegates have introduced twice now. It's called the Reducing Accidents in Locomotives Act, which has a lot of the changes to rail regulation in the country that have been called for since the train derailment. Representative Sykes says that's been blocked by Republican leadership for 3 years now, almost, who she says have been bought off by the rail lobby, who are putting that money over what their constituents need, what's best for the safety of Americans. So she's certainly frustrated. I mean, that does have great bipartisan support. When Vice President J.D. Vance was a senator, he had introduced the Senate version of that bill. So there was, I think, hope that with him in the White House, this maybe would get a push forward. We haven't seen that. It has been stalled for essentially the entire time it's been alive. So Representative Sykes is certainly frustrated about that. And the fact that President Trump and Vice President Vance have multiple times traveled to East Palestine and said that they would pass this legislation and help them. And in her mind, they haven't done anything. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because weeks after the derailment back in 2023, this bipartisan group of senators got together. So it included then U.S. Senator J.D. Vance, who's now the vice president, and then Senator Sherrod Brown. So it was bipartisan and they introduced a railroad safety bill. But then that bill was derailed, for lack of a better word. But why, of all things, right after the derailment, why couldn't that get through?
That's such a good question. I mean, there was certainly momentum for it that did... The Senate version of the bill did pass out of committee, but then Senate leadership never brought it to a floor vote. Mm-hmm. So it never got the opportunity for senators to weigh in on it more broadly. And I remember I spoke with then Senator Brown about this, and he was really adamant that it wasn't stalled, but he also shared concerns that the rail lobby was in the ears of Republican leadership in the Senate at the time, and that was what was causing it to not get a full floor vote. So it's kind of been the same pattern for the past 3 years.
I wanted to talk about some of the health issues that you've reported on and some of the ongoing medical research, because we talked about that earlier in the hour. Can you give us an overview of what you've reported on about medical conditions of people in East Palestine?
Yeah, absolutely. There are lots of people who either had experienced medical concerns in, you know, the days and months after, and some that say that they still have some of these symptoms. There was a survey that the University of Kentucky did this spring that found that 70% of participants reported nose irritation, sinus drainage, and sore throat. 40% reported coughing and wheezing. 42% reported headaches, and 25% reported tiredness and weakness. So there's still concerns, obviously long-term concerns about long-term health, and then also some symptoms that people still tie back to the derailment and the vent and burn of the vinyl chloride. Mm.
And I also wanted to ask you about firefighter training, because you recently wrote and produced a series about the severe shortage in Ohio of volunteer firefighters. And that does come into play here with East Palestine and this disaster, because it would have been a volunteer fire department would have been the first to respond to something like this. So in the 3 years since the train derailment, is there anything you can point to related to firefighters in that area?
Yes, absolutely. And I think this is probably the most substantial thing that has changed since we have seen most of that legislation stall at the federal level. This was something the National Transportation Safety Board recommended the state do, which is increase the amount of training volunteer firefighters need in Ohio, because right now they only get 36 hours. It does not include hazmat training. So the people pulling up to the train derailment 3 years ago really were underprepared to be able to act on an accident of that mass. Like they might not have had any hazmat training at all. So the state is doing that. In the next 5 years, they're going to be phasing out that 36-hour training. By 2030, all new volunteer firefighters will be required to get more than 100 hours of training versus that 36. That will include hazmat training. It will meet a national standard. that the National Firefighter Organization recommends that firefighters meet. So this is probably the most substantial thing, in my view, that has happened since the derailment, because a lot of the other NTSB recommendations are things that only Congress can act on and have seen a lot of pushback from the rail lobby or just a lack of action from the Department of Transportation. So this is really an actionable thing that the state has taken very seriously and we are finally seeing come to fruition. Mm-hmm.
We've been talking about the train derailment in East Palestine, which happened 3 years ago. And we've been talking with IdeaStream Public Media's Akron Canton reporter, Abigail Botar. Thank you so much for your time today, Abigail.
Thank you for having me.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. If you missed any part of today's show, be sure to listen back at our website, wosu.org/allsides. Subscribe to the podcast, and every episode is available to listen to for free in the WOSU Public Media mobile app. This is 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich. Thanks for joining us.
Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State, providing access to the most advanced cancer treatments available from a team specialized in treating just one type of cancer, yours. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/choosethejames.